people would argue that Johann Sebastian Bach is one of the best melodic writers in all of music history. When he would set a text, however, he didn't just write a beautiful melody. He became an artist, using every tool on his workbench and every color on his palette. On today's edition of the Epic Bach Week, we're looking at two of Bach's most beloved choral works, his Cantata No. 140 and his Magnificat in D major. I'm Robbie Rainey, your host, and this is the Epic Bach Week on the 3 B's, and today our subject is Bach the Artist. Good morning to you, and welcome to this Wednesday of the Epic Bach Week here on the 3 B's. So far this week, we've been celebrating the musical genius of Johann Sebastian Bach through his keyboard and church music. But today we turn to the genre of his music that is closest to my heart, his vocal and choral music. Our guest this morning is Dr. Genevieve Brown-Kibble. Dr. Kibble, it's so wonderful to have you with us this morning.
It's my privilege, Robbie. Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Kibble is the director of choral activities at Southern Adventist University. As the deacon, she conducts the choirs, teaches private voice lessons, and also teaches several music history classes. Dr. Kibble, if we're thinking of Johann Sebastian Bach as an artist, what kinds of things do we need to think of?
I think that part of what we can do today is to discover what are the tools that this musician artist is using to create these great works of art that we are still studying today.
Well, some of the tools that I know he used were the melody and the harmony, just the very simple things, the rhythm. He also used the text. What other kind of things would he have used to paint himself a musical picture?
Well, as we'll discover more directly in the music, rhythm is a really large umbrella term. Mm-hmm. Underneath that, we have things like how fast, the tempo, and then we have the meter and the kinds of beats that Bach would use to describe a certain part of the text. Are we using dotted notes, uneven kind of notes? Are we using long notes, short notes? And then how about things like articulation? How are those notes spoken? Are they short and abrupt, as in staccato? Are they long and connected, as in?
Legato, one of your favorite words, an Italian word that means connected.
Absolutely. And what makes Bach great, or any composer great, is the layering of all of these tools.
First off today, we'll be examining several movements from Bach's Magnificat in D major. Dr. Kibble, what can you tell us about Quia Respexit, the movement that we'll begin with?
Well, this is the third movement in 12 very concise movements. This is a really very short work when you look at Bach's larger works. It's written in Latin. There are not many of Bach's works that are written in Latin. This is post-Reformation.
Why didn't Bach write very much in Latin? He was a Latin teacher at the St. Thomas School.
Well, as again, post-Reformation, we're saying, let's have these religious works in the language of the people.
And remember, since Bach was German, he wrote in German.
And not just German, but what was his religious affiliation?
He was Lutheran.
Absolutely, and a very devout Lutheran at that. So we have a couple of these works, that texts that have been used for centuries, that Bach is writing in Latin, using the original Latin, and this is one of them.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the text of the Magnificat means?
My soul magnifies the Lord. This is Mary's bewildered exclamation, if you will, as she discovers that she's about to bear Christ, the Savior of the world.
We'll begin with the soprano aria, Quia Respexit. Since it's in Latin, I've worked up a little translation for you. Here it goes. For he has looked on the lowliness of his handmaiden, and from now on I will be called blessed by. You'll understand in just a moment why I cut off. What can we expect to hear in this first movement? How will Bach depict the lowliness of the handmaiden?
It starts right away with the oboe entrance. The soprano doesn't come in until the first five or so measures, and they seem fairly long because this is an adagio tempo, a slow tempo, and there's this descending scale, minor scales descending, a sense of bowing or kneeling that gives you this impression of servanthood.
Now, this particular aria comes to a wonderful, perfect cadence, right?
That would not be correct, and I know you just can't wait to tell us why that is.
Well, that is because you remember when I cut off in the translation, I will be called blessed by, it goes on all generations, omnes generationes, and you can just hear the generations marching and marching and marching. It's amazing how two words can tell such a story. We just heard the Omnes Generationes from Bach's Magnificat. They're the only two words in that movement, but in the movement, Bach depicts generation after generation after generation who will be calling Mary blessed for bearing Jesus Christ. You are listening to the Epic Bach Week on the 3Bs right here on WSMC. Today, Dr. Genevieve Brown-Kibble joins us to talk about Bach the artist. From Omnes Generationes, we turn to another choral movement from Bach's Magnificat. This is Fecit Potentiam. The translation is, "He has made known the power of his arm and scattered those who are arrogant in the thoughts of their heart." Dr. Kibble, what is the one word that our audience is sure to catch in this movement?
Well, if I had to pick one, I'd be in trouble, so I'll pick two. Strength, potency. I mean, really, it says he hath showed strength with his arm, and that's fecit potentiam. And just listen to the rhythm of that, potentiam. We have that sense of strength. But then he uses his strength to scatter the superbos, or
the proud in their hearts.
Yes. So how does this get depicted? Besides that rhythmic potentiam of the text declaimed this way, we have really several levels of counterpoint. We have the woodwinds acting together as a group, the strings together as a group, and the choirs together as a group, and they are coming in all at different times. But then alongside of those groups that are using a homophonic texture or lining up all together, we have a fugue subject that's being interjected. First starts with the tenors, taken over by the altos, then the soprano twos, the basses follow, soprano ones, and then it's crowned with the trumpet and flutes. So with all of this counterpoint, here is this long, elaborate, with melismatic, lots of running passages, setting of the text.
Let's listen to it now. This is Fecit Potentiam.
Fecit Potentiam.
Let's close this section of our program this morning with a tenor aria from the Magnificat. This aria comes directly after Fecit Potentiam, and it continues the thought of the previous movement. The aria says that he has put down the mighty from their seats of power and raised up those who are lowly. How does Bach go about showing that in his music?
Well, I think, first of all, let's imagine not put down, but thrown down, violently thrown down. You're going to hear this. We have the violins in unison, literally right from the get-go, tossing down this theme. They're being deposited, very, very forcefully deposited. And then we see with upturned scales, once again, when the humble are exalted, things change by going upwards.
What can you tell us about the tenor line at the beginning? He has a descending scale with a sudden jump of an awkward interval. Why would Bach choose that particular interval, and what's so special about it?
You have here this tritone, either an augmented fourth or diminished fifth, and it's difficult to sing, and there's a sense of twist to it. It also has a little bit of history of earlier being even called the devil's interval, if you will, by some. But you always will sit up and pay attention when you hear that interval.
The humble are then lowering themselves down. They're kneeling.
Yeah, it's a gentle kneeling. God. And we see, as toward the end of this movement, the umiles, that word painted in long tones. He holds that once he gets to umiles with long tones. He's holding the last for
about three measures.
Whereas we have in very short, abrupt notes, the ta 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 ta, just rhythmically, even if you didn't have any melody to it, just the rhythm would suggest the different kind of depositing.
Let's close the Magnificat, though without ending it, with Deposuit Potentes, an aria for tenor.
Deposuit potentes, descende et exalta.
With me during this hour is Dr. Genevieve Brown-Kibble, the Director of Choral Activities at Southern Adventist University. When she conducts, she doesn't use a strict 4-4 pattern, but instead follows the music and almost paints the sound she's looking for. She's really quite an artist, and that's part of the reason why I chose her to be my guest today on the Epic Bach Week, where our title is Bach the Artist. We've just heard several different movements from Bach's Magnificat in D major, which was written in 1733. Let's go back 2 years to the year 1731, when Bach wrote a cantata for a very rare Sunday in the church year, the 27th Sunday after Trinity, which only rolls around about once every 11 years, depending on how early Easter is that year. This Sunday would have been the last in the church year because the new year begins on the first week of the first Sunday of Advent, which is the next week.
With that in mind, we know that this is something that will come with great expectation, and we'll just see how it is that Bach demonstrates this expectation in this remarkable cantata.
Bach wrote as many as 5 or maybe even 6 yearly cycles of cantatas to be used in each Sunday's church service, and each cycle would have had between 50 and 60 cantatas in it.
I think about 58 were required for the church year, so that's a good number.
That means that Bach probably wrote upwards of 350 cantatas. Maybe that's a little high.
Some would say that, but that's not exorbitant.
That really makes me want to jump for joy. I love listening to cantatas, but there's only one problem. Only about half of the cantatas survived. The other half were used to wrap garbage or to line pie plates. Very useful things. But it's sad for a Bach lover that so much of his music that probably only existed in one copy was destroyed.
Well, I'm jumping for joy because we do have over 200
yes.
of them, which really ends up to be more two-thirds-ish. If even, Robbie, we had this particular one, I would be sad maybe to see that we didn't know what the others were, but this is a true treasure.
It is. So would the congregation have been allowed to sing along with the cantata, or would they have only been allowed to sing during the last verse, which is closest to what we would have in our hymnal, or would they have been expected to just keep quiet?
They absolutely would be singing on that final verse because this was the culmination. And again, the composer, in the way he would write this, would use the kind of not only chorale hymn tune, in this case one that's already very, very well known, but the congregation would be building with excitement as they saw the text unfold in music, and then they would just be jumping out of their skins, ready to finally participate.
Now, the tune that this cantata is based on is what we probably know in our hymnal as Wake, Awake, For Night Is Flying. In German, it's Wacht auf, ruft uns die Stimme. That hymn was as well known to Bach's church as the Old Rugged Cross or Amazing Grace is for us, and so they would have been able to recognize the tune sort of hidden throughout some of these earlier chorale movements. But in case you're not very familiar with the tune of Wacht auf, here's a little snip of it for you. There's a little snip of Wake, Awake, For Night Is Flying, written by Philip Nicolai and harmonized by J.S. Bach. We'll get to hear that whole cantata in just a moment, but let's start at the very beginning, though, and you'll hear the tune in the soprano, though it's slowed down quite a bit. Dr. Kibble, what can you tell us about this whole cantata? What's it about?
This is based on the parable that Jesus told about the virgins that were waiting, the 10 virgins, for the bridegroom, and those that had their lamps that were trimmed, the oil that was ready, or those that did not. We know, of course, that the bridegroom was later than expected, and so they fell asleep, and we know how the story goes from there. But the call that comes right away in this cantata is for us to awaken. Wacht auf, wake up. Something really exciting and important and vital is about to happen.
We come now to our first recitative and aria set. Dr. Kibble, what is a recitative and how does it fit with an aria?
Well, you can hear a root there that everybody would recognize, something that's recited. It almost has a sense of something that you would narrate. This is just very factual. And then when you have the aria that comes after this, this is more a lyrical response, if you will. Here are these dry kind of facts told by a solo voice with minimal accompaniment, mostly syllabic, one syllable per note. So there's that sense of reciting to it. It can be accompanied by continuo, just that keyboard continuo or two low instruments, or it can be accompanied by full orchestra. We have two recitatives here, and we see first, the first one is only with continuo. We call that secco recitative. And then the following, the later one, is accompanied.
Let's hear the text for the recitative. He comes, the bridegroom comes. O Zion's daughters, come out. His course runs from the heights into your mother's house. The bridegroom comes, who, like a roe and young stag, leaps upon the hills to you. He brings the wedding feast. Rise up, take heart to embrace the bridegroom. There, look, he comes this way. Those are the words for the recitative. Now, the aria is actually much shorter. When will you come, my Savior? I come as your portion. I wait with burning oil. Now open the hall. I open the hall for the heavenly meal. Come, Jesus, I come. Come, lovely soul. This is a beautiful conversation between your soul and Jesus.
Well, it's interesting too here, Robbie, that this is in a three-part form, this duet. You know, usually we follow recitative with an aria, which is a solo, but this, in this case, it's a duet in both cases through this cantata, because we're always in conversation with Christ and the bride, his church. And it's interesting that this first duet in movement two, it's in three parts. Now we're looking at the structure, which is just unique and very exquisite of this cantata. It's the structure of this duet is in three parts, but it's not the typical three-part, what we would call da capo, where you have a section that's united and then something that's different, a B section, and then the return to that A section. It's three parts, but it's irregular. And that's to help illustrate this in this first duet, the fact that things are not yet united. We're still waiting. There's still a questioning of when are you coming. In the next duet, which we'll talk more about later, then we have da capo form. There's that sense of things are right.
Let's listen to the first three movements of Bach's cantata number 140, Wacht auf, ruft uns die Stimme.
Thank you. kommt, er kommt, der Bräutigam kommt. Ihr Töchter Zions kommt heraus, sein Ausgang eilt aus der Höhe in euer Mutterhaus. Der Bräutigam kommt, der einem Rehe und jungen Hirsche gleich auf den Hügel springt und euch das Mahl der Hochzeit bringt. Wacht auf, ermuntert euch, den Bräutigam zu empfangen. Dort seht, kommt er hergegangen.
Ich komme,
mein Heil,
mein Teil.
We come now to the very central movement of Bach's Cantata number 140. It's based on the hymn tune Wacht auf, ruft uns die Stimme. And this is really only the second time that you'll get to hear the chorale tune that I hope you recognize from the first movement. You'll most definitely recognize this movement if you've ever been to a wedding or if you're familiar with Bach's chorale preludes. This is Sleepers Awake. It's scored in this for two violins and viola, along with the whole tenor section. Dr. Kibble, why would Bach do that? Why wouldn't he use the perfect section, the bass section?
Well, now we really are getting into humor by saying that, but all humor aside, the tenor section has that sense of horn call, if you will. These are the watchmen. They represent this call from the watchmen that are on the towers, and they are telling us that this bridegroom is coming. There's several things here that are just wonderful in the painting that Bach uses. The continuo is almost all steady quarter notes. This is that steady march of Christ. Christ is coming. His step is sure. And then we have the strings, violins and violas. They're in unison. There's a steadfastness there as well, but they're very decorative. This beautiful counter melody that we have going through to the chorale tune that you were just describing. This is also verse 2 of Nikolai's text. We saw verse 1 back in the very first movement. Bach loved this movement so much that it's the only cantata movement that he actually had published.
And we're absolutely lucky to have had it published. If it hadn't been, this cantata could have been among the third or so that didn't survive, and that would have been just absolutely heartbreaking. The text of this verse says, Zion hears the watchman sing. Her heart leaps for joy within her. She wakens and hastily arises. Her glorious friend comes from heaven, strong in mercy, powerful in truth. Her light becomes bright, her star rises. Now come, precious crown, Lord Jesus, the Son of God. Hosanna! We all follow to the hall of joy and hold the evening meal together.
Well, until this point, we have been in anticipation. And by this pinnacle, this middle movement, movement 4, we now are assured that Christ indeed will be present, and not just that he will come, but that we will all follow, as you just mentioned, to the banquet hall. We will all share. So the cantata turns from here on from expectation to fulfillment of the expectation.
Thank you.
come now to another recitative and aria set, paraphrasing from one of the most romantic passages in the Bible, Song of Solomon 8:6. So come into me, you my chosen bride. I have to you eternally betrothed myself. I will set you upon my heart, upon my arm as a seal, and delight your troubled eye. Forget, O soul, now the fear, the pain which you have had to suffer. Upon my left hand you shall rest, and my right hand shall kiss you. Bach didn't dwell so much on the prophetic part of this parable, but he spent much more time with the bridegroom coming to fetch his bride and just how absolutely madly in love they are.
That's correct. And here we have the recitative that leads into the aria. Now we have, as I mentioned earlier, an accompanied recitative. There's more of a sense of fulfillment here as we add more instruments. And the aria that follows, which is, of course, once again a duet, is that da capo aria. There's a sense now of completion. They are together again. Happiness is assured. The recitative says, all of the pain that you've suffered now will be no more. Enter with me, you, my chosen bride.
So geh herein zu mir, du mir erwählte Braut. Ich habe mich mit dir in Ewigkeit vertraut. Ich will dich auf mein Herz, auf meinen Arm gleich wie ein Siegel setzen und ein liebes Aug ergötzen. Vergiss, o Seele, nun die Angst, den Schmerz, den du erduldest. Meiner Linken sollst du ruhen und meine Rechte soll dich
mit mir, du sollst mit mir,
du sollst mit mir,
We just heard the final recitative and aria from Bach's Cantata number 140, and we were talking a little bit about the meaning of the text that Bach chose to set. This is true love, the kind of love that I hope to experience someday, the same kind of love that's at least a picture of how Christ feels for us, his church, the undying love that he has for us. Dr. Kibble, can you comment on this just a little bit? I think you can say it better than I can.
Well, I think you've said it very well, Robbie, but you did talk earlier about the reference to Song of Solomon. And as we all know, that is very poetic descriptions of romantic love. And so in a way, we're being told here not only by Christ, who himself calls the church his bride, but through this parable and through Bach's depiction of this, we are hearing in movement 5 and 6, this love duet. They have finally come together. And as mentioned earlier, we have this sense of completion with the da capo aria. And that love is made firm, more firm, by the presence of the community. Mm-hmm. The community then, in this final movement, the congregation, they join in to celebrate this love. This is not a hidden love away in some undescribable kind of scene. This is a love that everyone is happy about. So we symbolize that as we come back to the chorale in this final movement, movement 7, where the congregation joins. They're singing in harmony. but there is a sense of unity by this kind of texture. So Bach, as a great composer with all the tools at his disposal, he sets many aside to make this final movement even more cohesive, more powerful, more a sense of we are all celebrating this great feast of the bridegroom together. This is now set in heaven.
We heard the final movement of Bach's Cantata No. 140, Wacht auf, ruft uns die Stimme. During the program, we heard the complete cantata as performed by the Amsterdam Baroque Orchestra and Chorus, led by Ton Koopman. My special guest for this morning has been Dr. Genevieve Brown-Kibble. Thank you, Dr. Kibble, for joining us to talk about something that seems to be both of our passions, Bach and his great artistry.
It has been a distinct privilege, Robbie.
And thank you for joining us this morning for this edition of the Epic Bach Week right here on the 3Bs. Be sure to join us again tomorrow at 11 a.m. when I'll talk to Reinhard Goebel about Bach the Instrumentalist. Until tomorrow, be sure to keep your radio dial set to Classical 90.5 for performance today. Until tomorrow, have a wonderful day.